From NPR, it's Latino USA. In the days that followed the attacks on September 11th, we were a nation and a world united. But over the years, life has gone on, and many of us have forgotten those that sacrificed to help get New York and the nation up and running again.
Undocumented workers who worked in the cleanup of Ground Zero deserve a legalization. This group of workers deserves to be legalized for their work, for their sacrifices.
On today's program, Immigrant Workers at Ground Zero, a conversation with an undocumented man who spent 6 months of his life at the site. So, who has his back? Also, La Musica Sublime, sublime sounds from New York-based Pachamassive. That's coming up on Latino USA. Stay with us. For the news of the week, we turn now to the U.S.-Mexico border. While Juarez has been at the center of attention with regards to drug cartel violence for the past few years, it seems as though the focus has begun to shift to other regions along the Texas border. Officials in the Rio Grande Valley say they're preparing for violence brought on by both Los Zetas and the Gulf Cartel, which they believe are only getting stronger and more dangerous. Joining us to discuss this matter is reporter Monica Ortiz Uribe, who is based in El Paso and specializes in border issues. She also reports for Latino USA. Monica, thanks for being with us.
You're very welcome, Maria. It's a pleasure.
What's changed over the past, you know, couple of months in terms of this violence spreading?
Well, the violence has not necessarily changed in Ciudad Juarez, nor has it slowed down. There's a deceiving trend that occurs whenever the Mexican government shifts focus towards Juarez, in that the killings go down for a short period of time and then they start up again. This happened a year ago during a surge of military and federal police presence to the city. And we're seeing it again now with the two visits by President Felipe Calderon. Back in December, Juarez was averaging 10 murders a day. But in the weeks surrounding the president's visit, the murders decreased to about 3 or 4 a day. But now they're back up again. Last Friday, there were 13 people killed. And on Wednesday, 11 people were killed.
Those are some pretty extraordinary numbers. I mean, 10 people on a daily basis. Do you read about this on the front pages of your newspapers every day down there?
Yes, sadly so. Just to list a few of the deaths in the last month, there was a father and his infant son that were shot dead at a racetrack. There were two people who were shot and killed at a beauty salon. And there was another attack against a house party a week ago. And in that attack, one college student was killed and 7 others were injured. And just this week, there was reports of 6 men who were killed at a ranch in the rural outskirts of Juarez. So yes, despite all the government attention and the presence of thousands of federal police and military, the violence in Ciudad Juarez continues.
All right, so last week there were reports about multiple shootings that happened in Valle Hermoso, that's near Matamoros, and in Reynosa, so that's in a totally different part of the border than Juarez. So is there a concern now that officials have to do something so that they can ensure that these cities don't essentially become just like Juarez?
Absolutely. Some years ago, before the violence began in Juarez, there was an increase of violence in that same area, which to a certain extent has decreased dramatically. But this is, I think, the first time we're seeing an upsurge of violence in that area again, which, yes, is of course worrisome. As far as I know, there hasn't been any sweeping effort on the part of the Mexican government to address the violence near Nuevo Laredo and Reynosa just yet. But, schools were shut down for a while. The American consulate in Reynosa was also closed for a while, but has since reopened. And there is also a presence of Mexican military in that area.
So, Monica, how do you handle this? I mean, you're a reporter. You're based down in El Paso. This is your region. But, you know, assaults on regular people, on journalists. So how are you handling it?
It's different every day. When I have to go out to Juarez, some days I feel just fine, and I always take the common sense precautions. I'm aware of my surroundings. I make sure someone knows where I am at all times. But really, I think what keeps me going is that this is where I was born and raised in El Paso. And as a little girl, I'd frequent Juarez with my family just to go shopping, to eat out, to buy Coca-Cola. And so I feel a real responsibility to this region and to cover it fairly and accurately. So I think that's kind of what gives me the courage to go and report there on a weekly basis.
Monica, thank you for doing that for all of us. We appreciate your work, and take care of yourself.
No problem. You're very welcome.
Monica Ortiz Uribe is a reporter and Latino USA contributor based out of El Paso, Texas. It's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. The aftershocks have continued in Chile in the days since last weekend's massive 8.8 earthquake. Chile's president, Michelle Bachelet, called the quake an unthinkable disaster, saying her country was in a state of catastrophe. Despite the quake's magnitude, the death toll was far less than the recent earthquake in Haiti, but the sense of panic was the same. Eduardo Gallardo is the former bureau chief for the AP in Concepcion, the hardest hit city in Chile.
It was very, very strong. I've been through several earthquakes in Chile in for a long time, and this is probably one of the strongest that I've felt. They were running down the street, screaming, some people crying.
In the immediate aftermath of last weekend's earthquake, tsunami alerts went up around the Pacific Rim. Coastal Chile has a history of very large quakes. Since 1973, there have been 13 magnitude 7 or greater quakes. And in 1960, seismologists measured a magnitude 9.5 earthquake, 140 miles from the epicenter of February 27th's quake. The process of rebuilding has begun in Chile, and it continues in Haiti. Relief efforts continue as well. For more information on how you can help, visit our website at latinousa.org. From the disaster in Chile, we turn now to one much closer to home. Years have passed since the terrorist attacks on September 11th, 2001. Almost a decade, in fact. And while that tragedy will never be forgotten, the immediate pain has faded for many Americans. But do you remember those days after September 11th? Remember how we were all united? How those involved in the rescues that day and those who were involved in the cleanup were considered heroes? 9 years later, some of those workers who cleaned up the toxins and debris near Ground Zero are suffering from chronic health issues. For the hundreds of immigrant workers who were involved, these problems are further aggravated by an unresolved immigration status and a lack of health care. Now those workers are coming together to call for comprehensive immigration reform. We're joined now by Daniel Coates. He's an organizer with Make the Road New York, an advocacy organization promoting economic justice and equality. And we're joined also by Jose Gaviria. He's a Colombian immigrant who spent months cleaning up around Ground Zero. Welcome to both of you. Gracias por estar aquí.
Thanks for having us.
Daniel, let's start with you. Everyone knows that the cleanup of Ground Zero was it was massive. It was a rough job. But paint a picture of the immigrant workers who were involved in the cleanup.
To paint a picture, so the towers fall, lower Manhattan is covered in dust and in debris, and it's just a massive job. And so the word goes out to all of the cleanup workers and folks who do these sorts of jobs in the city who are immigrants— So not only, you know, people feel personally attacked because, you know, it's their city and they've been living there, whether they're documented or not. And then there comes this call of, hey, we need people to go. And people just showed up, got in big lines, signed up to work with very little protection, and just started cleaning buildings all around Ground Zero for months.
And these workers, who at the time were really seen as heroes, essentially were unprotected because they didn't, many of them, of the immigrant workers, didn't even have papers.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely right. All the procedures for protecting folks for dangerous materials were not really followed. You know, wear a small paper mask, you know, eat lunch in the area that you've managed to sweep out in the morning, you know, right next to all the toxic materials that you're going to be cleaning up in the afternoon. You know, none of this stuff was thought of.
So, Jose, you are an undocumented Colombian immigrant. You arrive in New York in 1999. When September 11th happens, is there something that says to you, you know, this is my city now where I live, is we've been attacked by terrorists, and I feel a responsibility to help?
Well, more than anything, I think that there was a spirit of collaboration. We wanted to be united, not just as workers, but also as volunteers.
So you are literally in the midst of Ground Zero. Can you tell us, Jose, a little bit about what you did, what you saw, what it was like?
Esos días eran impactantes. Era un tremendo desasosiego todo el día.
Those days were intense. There was always a sense of uneasiness in the air, and you would constantly hear the sirens of ambulances. Every day we would see bodies being recovered, being placed in the black bags. We would work in tall buildings, and there would be alarms going off, and the foreman would yell that there was a bomb or some other danger, and we'd have to run down the stairs to the first floor. It was crazy every day, and really everyone developed psychological problems from the trauma.
Los problemas psicológicos que tenemos todos hoy son traumatizantes.
When you were hired, Jose, to do the cleanup around Ground Zero, were you warned about possible hazardous materials or toxic materials or even psychological? Did anybody come and say, look, what you're going to do, you're going to be exposed, whether it's on a physical level or emotional level or a psychological level? Did anyone ever talk to you about that?
En ningún momento, ningún subcontratista,
none of the contractors or subcontractors that hired us ever told us that there was chemicals or pollution in the air. In fact, it was the opposite. They'd say, let's get to work because there's nothing to worry about. But we never got any masks or protective equipment. They would say, if you want that, go buy it yourself.
Si quieres protección, cómprala tú.
You now have a couple of health issues after the months that you spend cleaning up around the Ground Zero area. So what are the health issues that you face now?
Well, I have several problems. I have 5 herniated discs in my spine. I have bacteria in my stomach, which causes acid reflux, and I have chronic rhinitis.
And what, for example, what do you hear from your fellow co-workers who are down there cleaning, doing other cleanup? What's a typical, like when you get together and you're having a coffee or un café con leche and you're talking about what's going on, what do these workers who helped clean up, what do they talk about in terms of typical health issues that they have?
En ese entonces no habían enfermedades respecto al World Trade Center.
Well, right after working at the World Trade Center site, we really didn't have any symptoms. But the doctor that checked us out for the first time in 2003 told us that problems like ours take time to manifest. They are long-term diseases. So really, it's only been in the last few years that we are seeing people getting sick. We have people who have had throat and stomach operations. One of my friends, Virginia in Brooklyn, had operations for stomach cancer, and to this day, she has not gotten any compensation.
Señora se encuentra bien mal desde acá de Brooklyn. Y en este momento no ha recibido el caso de compensación todavía.
So, Daniel, you held a news conference this week in New York, basically getting these workers together to give testimonial about what they've experienced and basically calling for comprehensive immigration reform. Is there any hope whatsoever that that these particular workers who worked on, you know, the Ground Zero site and around it have any kind of hope in terms of any immigration reform, let's just say just for them, the people who worked on this tragic place?
The two big immigration-related messages that we wanted to get out there are undocumented workers who worked in the cleanup of Ground Zero deserve a legalization. This group of workers deserves to be legalized for their work, for their sacrifices. And then also, as Jose was saying, you know, we needed immigration reform for everybody. You know, the experience of 9/11 and the way that this group of workers responded is indicative of, you know, the way that immigrants are responding across the country to small scale tragedies and to everyday occurrences, and so we think that you know, these two things are something that we're pushing for.
Thank you so much for joining us, Jose, and thank you, Daniel.
Thanks for having us.
Okay, muchas gracias. Thank you.
Jose Gaviria is a former worker involved with the cleanup around Ground Zero, and Daniel Coates is an organizer with Make the Road New York. And now for some personal thoughts. So there I was, sitting next to the Secretary General of the United Nations. I was the moderator for the UN's official celebration of International Women's Day. There was a panel discussion among women leaders from Tanzania, the Philippines, Peru, China, and Canada. These were the women who helped create the UN Women's Meeting in Beijing 15 years ago, the most highly attended UN conference in history with 50,000 people, many of them women. As I listened to the panelists speak, addressing this huge conference room and a worldwide satellite audience, the women talked about lessons we should learn from the Beijing conference. One of the leaders who was in charge of the entire conference, reporting to the Secretary General, said, "We must learn from the process. The process of the women's meeting in Beijing was inclusive. This is essential." I felt so invigorated by this notion and by the entire feel of the UN. This week, they're celebrating women, and the place is packed, overflowing with women activists who have arrived from all over the world to attend these events. There were indigenous activists from Guatemala and Peru, Chinese ministers representing women and girls, grassroots activists from Harlem, and European Union dignitaries, all women. Inclusivity, I said to myself as I walked along 42nd Street to the NPR Bureau, where I then did the interview with the undocumented 9/11 worker. After the interview, I felt sad. Jose Gaviria's situation is the opposite of inclusivity. It is the manifestation of government and society's exclusivity. You don't have a paper that says you can be in this country officially. Therefore, you are excluded from everything, even from the healthcare benefits that you need because you're sick, because you did your patriotic duty after September 11th and actually went down to that place every day for months. You smelled that place. You touched that place. You allowed your body to get covered with the ash remains of thousands of New Yorkers, allowed your body to be covered in sometimes toxic debris. You lived 9/11 more than so many of us, and now you are sick. And now you, Jose Gaviria, can't get help because you don't have a paper that gives you permission to be in this country. People like Jose are the inclusive ones. They saw themselves as New Yorkers and as Americans on 9/11, and they did their duty. So why is the American government the one that continues to encourage exclusivity and not inclusivity? Yes, we all need to learn from the lessons of the Beijing Women's Conference 15 years ago. All of us. Ya salió el sol, me tengo que levantar. Va a ser un día largo, me tengo que preparar. In a minute, one of my favorite groups, El Sonido Bilingüe, the bilingual songs of New York's Bacha Massive. That's coming up. Stay with us. No se vayan. You're listening to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Pacha Massive is the brainchild of Dominican-born songwriter and producer Ramon Nova and Colombian-born bassist Maya Martinez. The group's sophomore album is out now. It's entitled If You Want It, and I'm joined by Pacha Massive frontman Ramon Nova at the NPR studios in New York. Welcome back to the show, Nova.
Hello, how are you?
It's great to have you back.
Long time since Dominican Republic.
Long time, but you know, this is the funny thing about it, Nova, is that your first CD basically became kind of like the soundtrack to the past 2 years. I was like, when is Pacha gonna get out another CD? Because I need to change, because I listen to it at least, I don't know, one or two times a week. I mean, it's like part of my... You have this thing about getting into people's souls with the rhythm, with the kind of hypnotic stuff that you do. I mean, this is totally on purpose on your part, I'm sure.
Well, yeah, I do have to say that I kind of like to make things as simple as I possibly can make them. And that's something really hard to do. So I think if you just try to, you know, stick with simplicity as the end result of whatever you do, I think, you know, people won't have too much of a hard time understanding what it is that you're trying to do.
This time you actually brought on a couple of interesting singers. Monica Rodriguez, and some people might know her from the rock band Zigmat. Talk to me about bringing in this kind of a voice into your music, and what was it like to be working with Monica?
It was pretty cool. I mean, the second album as well as the first, they both include a different number of people, especially female singers, that come in and kind of complete the whole vibe of the record and stuff. But working with her in particular was really cool because she's the type of person who, like most musicians, you know, she doesn't have a chip on her shoulders. She's, you know, she doesn't have anything to prove. So creating with her is something that is very easy. And she's extremely talented. She plays a few instruments herself. She has a really good understanding of the music in general.
She does vocals in the song If You Want It, which is the first cut in the CD, am I right? Talk a little bit about that song. I mean, it's a pretty powerful way to start. It's just like, if you want it, ven, búscalo.
Of course, because what else are you going to do, you know? I mean, everybody who comes here, and I guess I kind of take that philosophy from my own experience as an immigrant. Everybody comes here to, you know, to come and get it. So whatever it is that you want, hopefully something positive. You know, it's very simple. You just have to get up and complement your dreaming with action, and you have to actually go and get it, you know?
You have two versions of the song, Thinking of You. Talk about both versions and why you decided to have both versions in the CD.
Well, the first version was is the last version on the album, which is a pretty, like, I don't know, maybe bluesy, very chilled out, whatchamacallit, down-tempo kind of track, which on that track I'm using Sara Valenzuela.
From Mexico.
From Mexico, which is a great singer on vocals and stuff. And, you know, the label basically wanted to hear something different, and I just basically took the original version, rendered out the vocals and a couple of the instruments, and then did a whole nother track and stuff. Can't stop.
You were a young kid when you came to the United States, yeah. though. So, you know, I saw you a couple of years ago on your first CD, and now, you know, you're getting older here. But I'm still, the question that I have is, how does a young Dominican immigrant who doesn't even arrive in this country speaking the language, you know, basically 15 years later, is able to manage working with music producers and labels, you know, and people think, well, God, the music business is so complicated. So how'd you do it in the sense of learning the business?
I don't know the business. I mean, the business is so complicated and it changes so much that it's impossible to really, you know, figure it out. You have the lawyers sitting, you know, basically making sure that it's difficult for us to understand what it is that, you know, they're trying to do with the music. But I just keep working. And when things are not looking good, I know that they eventually will. And just to kind of try to stay centered, when things are going well, I know that at some point they're going to go kind of, you know, cold again. So I kind of just try to keep myself grounded and just keep producing music. And that's, at least for me, that's the only choice I have and the only thing I know how to do and the only thing I'm going to do.
And when you first started writing, this whole idea of writing in los dos idiomas, you know, de repente en inglés, de repente en español, you know, going back and forth. Did you think about that? Or was that, when you just sat down to write, was that simply the way it came out?
Yeah, it was. I mean, when I actually started doing it, it was at a time where, you know, it wasn't accepted by mainstream society. My first album came out in 1998, and at that time I had people, A&Rs and label people telling me, but why don't you just do an album in Spanish, or why don't you just do an album in English? You know, because people don't understand that, like mixing the languages. And I was like, I don't know who you're talking to, because I understand it. And I'm sure I'm not the only person in the United States that does so. And right now it's the norm. So, I mean, it's something that I never really thought about, or I never jumped on the bandwagon per se. It's just the way we grow up here in the United States, having a dual culture.
Pues ojalá que puedas seguir haciendo esa música buena. Keep on making that great music. Muchas gracias, Nova.
Thank you for having us, and we look forward to being here again.
Ramon Nova is the frontman of Pacha Massive. Their new album, If You Want It, is available from Nacional Records. And for this week, this has been Latino USA. Thanks for listening. We had help this week from Manolita Weatherill and John Wardle at NPR New York. Our listener comment line is 800-535-5533, and our email address is lusa@npr.org. Production support for Latino USA comes from KUT Radio, the University of Texas at Austin, and the William and Salome Scanlon Foundation of Austin and San Antonio. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week for another edition of NPR's Latino USA.
Support for NPR is provided by the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide at fordfoundation.org. By Lumber Liquidators, whose flooring includes pre-finished and stained solid hardwoods, bamboo, cork, and laminates. Information at lumberliquidators.com. And by LendingTree, whose financial tools include Loan Coach, offering personalized advice for every step of the lending process at LendingTree.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.